Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lambert today is deputy editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, the energy overhaul. Is Uber-style smart meter pricing for our bills the way to a greener, cheaper future? Or is it all just a bit creepy? Simon tackles what you need to do to beat rising inflation with rates so low. Can you invest your way to a house deposit? Plus the second-hand cars that have risen the most in value. And Hollywood comes to Burnley. The Bank of Dave gets the Netflix movie treatment. Don't forget you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, we have on this podcast spoken a lot about energy of late, rather unsurprisingly. But has a solution to the future of a more sustainable and greener energy supply been found? A smart meter overhaul will mean energy suppliers automatically receiving updates on how much power you're using every half an hour of every day. Suppliers could then use that data to change prices as often as 48 times a day. Lee Boyce. I don't know why. Smart meters, I just think of you. Time of tariffs, though. Explain.
When you said smart meter overhaul, I thought you were going to say smart meter overlord. I thought that's what you were going to say. And I was fully on board with that, Georgie.
Yeah.
Smart overlord inside your house.
Kinda. Yes.
I think that this story has been on the cards for a little while, if I'm being quite frank, Georgie. And it plays into the fears of a lot of our readers who have contacted us in their droves over the years about the need for a smart meter. Do they have to get a smart meter? You know, lots of energy firms needing to meet targets and sort of almost like bribing people into getting a smart meter to try and push them into it. And the topic that always came up time and time again was, are smart meters in the house to eventually have a system in which your rate of energy, the price that you pay, could fluctuate throughout the day? And the way I always think about this is, you know, there's always those stories, or there used to be, about everyone putting on the kettle at half time on a football match that had been televised on terrestrial TV, or in the adverts of Coronation Street, for example. And there's a big surge because everyone's putting the kettle on and the grid sort of gets under strain because everyone's making that cuppa. Well, this is kind of that to like another degree, because what Ofgem is potentially going to have the power, well, will have the power to do from May, is to give half-hour readings to your energy supplier via your smart meter, which then gets a much bigger snapshot of what's going on and how people are consuming energy, rather than the traditional way, which is to usually have a meter located somewhere on your property, usually on the outside in one of those boxes. Mm. And then start to charge people different rates at different times. Ofgem says that kind of fully operational system won't happen till about 2025, but it plays into a lot of fears. Now, you asked me about, you know, the tariffs and things. Now, we've had for a long time tariffs which you can use overnight. So Economy 7 tariffs, which mean cheaper energy overnight when people, you know, between the hours of sort of 11 o'clock and 5 a.m., the grid is at its lowest point. You know, people tend not to use as much energy, you know, because they're asleep during that time. You know, that depends on your shift patterns at work and you know, if you've got a young baby.
Insomnia,
you know, those types of things. But on the whole, that is kind of how it works. And if you have one of those tariffs, some people like to set their washing machine, for example. A lot of washing machines, modern washing machines, have a setting where you can time it to come on at a certain hour of the night, you know, to take advantage of a slightly cheaper tariff, which again is an ideal thing for families, for example, if you've got lots of washing to do all the time.
Not ideal if you live in an apartment block, because they get
not
really
ideal
noisy
for that. And even like morning. I live in a semi-detached house, and I hear neighbours have the washing machine on. They probably hear when we have the washing machine on. So, you know, yeah, not great if you're putting that on overnight and you're in close proximity of someone. Now, the talk about having all of the, having tariffs, having, you know, pricing at different hours, every half an hour in a day, plays into a lot of our fears over smart meters. And let's face it, they've been divisive anyway, Georgie. You have a lot of people that just don't want one, don't believe in, don't know what benefit they're going to have. We could keep being having it rammed down our throats that you can see how much energy you're using in pounds and pence. But in real world terms, most people, you know, are pretty sensible with their energy. They kind of know, you know, not to leave the lights on, not to, you know, keep their thermostat 1 or 2 degrees down, that kind of thing. I don't really think that a large majority of people need to be mollycoddled into knowing how much they're spending at any time on their energy. And that's my personal opinion. That's my point of view. And we have had readers get in touch with us in the past to tell us that they love their smart meter. And actually, they do like to be able to see how much they're spending at any given hour. And it just depends on the type of person you are and if you enjoy that or not. The smart meter rolled out itself. We won't go too far down this tunnel because
that's a whole podcast in itself, Lee.
It's cost billions of pounds.
Yeah.
A lot of the stats suggest that they don't really save us all that much money.
I thought they actually added like around £18 to your bill. Have I got that the wrong way around?
It depends. No, I don't know about that. It depends where you read the stats from. You know,
well, that's true.
Yeah, it's really hard. I mean, what Ofgem are saying about this is that actually it will revolutionise the way we consume energy here. It will help us get to our net zero targets, and that it will save, I think, something like £1.6 billion a year, potentially for households. That's a hard sell to people, though. That is a hard sell to people that don't want sort of big brother, I say in those kind of like, you know, inverted commas, type devices inside their home monitoring what they're doing all the time. And then we, of course, have had this real bonkers thing in which we had these first generation smart meters, SMETS 1, that have now started, well, I've been going dumb. I think I read the other day that the 5G network rollout will completely make them rudderless, and then getting a SMETS 2 device, you know, next generation, people that were early adopters into getting a smart meter, I've jumped the gun too early because the technology has changed. So we've had all of that, and it just feels like it's been billions of pounds worth of waste, and I just wonder if there was a better way to approach and tackle all of this. The worry is, though, Georgie, about all this is that there are people that do use energy in different ways. You know, low-income households, people that might need 24 hours round-the-clock care, for example. There's a lot of questions as opposed to answers at the moment around this, and we're trying to get more clarity. We're working behind the scenes. We've had a lot of people get in touch about this, and the thing we always do at This Is Money is that we do try and give as balanced an opinion as possible. You know, we try and answer all of the questions. We go off to Ofgem and Smart Energy GB and ask them what this is all about, but then we also listen to our readers and we go to other experts, you know, who are kind of a little bit further removed from this to find out what it actually means. So
yeah,
there's a lot of parts to this. As I say, I think it's always kind of been on the cards. I'm sure I read about this a few years ago, but it's kind of reared its head this week again in the press. And people are worried, and potentially rightly so. I was just reading a piece that was in the Daily Mail today about, for example, more people might be tempted to do their washing overnight, and that could lead to more fires. You know, the safety risk of having washing machines on overnight. You know, okay, that's a bit extreme, but it's still
these are concerns to think about, Lee. I've got a lot of things, a lot of questions about this. The £18, by the way, is what we pay in our bills to pay for this rollout. That's what I mean, is it's added £18 to our bills. In terms of this, privacy is an issue, I guess. Until we get smart homes where we can program things at certain times of the day, I get a bit concerned. Big brother is watching, or a criminal is watching, hacking into your smart meter. Is this possible? Have I gone a bit dystopian with this? And can know exactly when you're in and using your energy. I don't think they care when you're using your washing machine, but they might care when you're in and when you're out. But Simon, help me out on this one. Let's just go back to basics. Why is it more expensive to use energy at a time when everyone else is? Now, I can understand this was related to sort of coal-fired power plants. It was more expensive to keep them running overnight, etc. So they would give you better deals to use energy then because it made it more worthwhile. But in nowadays, why is that?
Well, the thinking behind this is that what they want to do is try to smooth electricity usage. And that's a key element in the shift to renewable energy. The problem that we have with the shift to renewable energy is that, as we know, it's not there all the time. For example, for approximately half the day, depending on what time of year you're in, the sun is not shining. The wind may not be blowing. And so we've got this issue with having that backup power that we need. And that's what a lot of the focus is on in the energy industry at the moment, because it's very difficult to store renewable energy and then draw on it when you need it. A large chunk of our bills, as we've spoken about in recent weeks, don't just come from the energy that we use, be that the gas that we use or the electricity that we use. A large part of the bills comes from network costs. It comes from the money that's going towards this transition to greener energy. It comes from trying to plan for this element of, okay, how do we keep the power on when it's most needed? And to go back to what Lee was saying, it's the classic switch the kettle on at halftime scenario. Now, this is only going to get more of a problem as people start to drain the grid. They're not going to completely drain the grid, sorry. As people start to draw on the grid with things like electric cars. I mean, you're taking a huge amount of energy, you're putting it into the car. Now, you've got a scenario where most people, maybe they're going to get home from work at round about the same time. They're going to park their car, they're going to plug it in, and all of a sudden the car's going to start drawing on it. We have had stories in the past, back in the good old days when energy was considerably cheaper, i.e. approximately about a year and a half, 2 years ago, where we had stories from companies like Octopus, which has these agile tariffs, where there were some electric car owners at one point who got paid to charge their car because there was surplus energy coming into the grid from renewable sources. And so they were paid to actually take it out of there. Now, the idea is, if you can get everybody's smart meters telling the electricity providers what's going on, how we're using energy, then they can start to try to adjust the pricing so that it encourages us to do certain things at times when less people are going to want to use the energy. Now, in theory, that saves us money. It saves us money in two ways. One, we can actually choose to do stuff when it's cheaper, stuff that's big electricity use, charging your car, using your washing machine. Not quite there on maybe actually getting everybody's washing machine able to just switch itself on at 3 o'clock in the morning. But, you know, things are getting smarter. The other thing is it actually removes some of the cost that's needed to go into planning for this whole, how do we keep enough electricity there? Because if we can smooth people's usage, we get less spikes, there's less of an issue for the grid and the industry in terms of providing it. I think the big concern amongst many people is that whilst they can totally understand that, even if they don't have a problem with the smart meter thing, which some people do, some people don't. I've got a smart meter. I think it's really good because my energy company knows exactly how much electricity I'm using and I get charged the right amount every month.
Whereas when I've had a smart meter in your cupboard for years though.
Well, there's two parts of a smart meter.
All right.
You've got the smart meter, which is the bit that's actually telling the energy company how much electricity you're using. And then you've got the little display that tells you in your house how much energy you're using. And smart meters were always sold to people as this kind of, hey, you can really cut down on your energy usage because you can see when you're using lots. Now, lots of people like me, that little digital display in the house went straight into the cupboard because, I mean, it was on the side in the kitchen and you had to plug it in. and that was where we plugged in the phones and stuff to charge. And it was there for a while and get rid of that.
The really useful
thing about smart meters is the bit where your bills are correct. You are not having to take meter readings and then send them off, and then they give you a random bill every 3 months and it swings around like crazy. So it helps you manage your money in that sense, which is maybe worth the £18 that you were talking about. But if you're happy with the smart meters and all these other things, you might still have some concerns about this because, let's face it, energy is provided by a number of private companies. They are profit-making organizations. And once you get everybody into the scenario where they've got a smart meter that's sending back information regularly and so that they can try and manage the prices, peak time, not peak time, off peak, all that kind of stuff, Are we led to believe that these companies are just going to accept that this is going to overall save us money and they're going to take lower revenues and therefore lower profits off the back of it? Or are we going to find what often happens with companies where there's something that comes up that saves people money? They go, okay, yeah, but we're making less money now. And all of a sudden those prices start to rise. Now, this is my exact problem with water meters, for example, which in theory, great idea, pay for what you use rather than paying on some totally random calculation, which some people do. But even if you take that argument that for most people a water meter would save them money, are we led to believe that the private companies with shareholders and big dividends to pay and bosses who are earning millions of pounds a year are going to accept lower revenues and profits? No, of course we're not, because we have handed our energy system, our electricity, our gas, our water to private companies. And that's why I think people have an underlying concern over this. Also, in this weird way, smart meters have become part of this ongoing culture war where you've got real tribalism on one side and on the other side. And that's why these stories ignite such passion amongst people. And the only thing I would say, though, is I already thought my smart meter was telling my energy supplier how much energy I was using throughout the day. I actually didn't realise it was only doing it once a day. I thought it was constantly doing it anyway.
You have to opt in, don't you? But it can do it now. It can do it every 30 minutes.
But I thought it was. I honestly thought it was. I mean, I've got, I think some of these agile tariffs, I think they're very interesting. We've done stuff on them before, as I said, with that time when people were paying to charge their cars and things like that. There's loads of really interesting stuff going on here. I could totally see the logic behind it. My concern is private enterprise, revenue, profits, fat cat wages. Are they really going to cut back? There's not been any evidence of that in the past.
So, Lee, nationalisation, and what's going to happen to the price cap?
It's a really tricky one, that. And that is a really good question about how you then have a price cap if the price of energy is going to fluctuate in half an hour periods throughout the day. I'm not fully sure what will happen with that and what the future of the price cap would look like. You know, would there just be a cap on the maximum that you could charge any given period is probably how it would be done. You know, in terms of not giving that, you've got to think about it in a kind of how much you're using per kilowatt hour, not by this the bigger sum that we're looking at. I would have thought that they would have to put a figure there that you could easily read, that would be the maximum that they could charge in a half an hour period.
Because it does sound rather arbitrary, doesn't it? And let's be honest, the energy providers, well, the fact that we've got an energy price cap in place in the first place shows that Ofgem and the government weren't exactly trustful that they were pricing correctly.
Yeah, and then, you know, let's rewind a little bit about the price cap. Before all of this, you know, wholesale costs were going up, there was a lot of, you know, talk about they were pricing, energy firms were just pricing it right at the price cap. You know, there was a lot of argument that actually, well, that is the price cap. Why are you sort of pricing it there? So as Simon says, you can't really trust private companies. At the end of the day, they're there to make a profit. Not, you know, there's some energy firms that you could argue were a little bit better than that. You know, they're not just focusing on the bottom line, but let's face it, that's what private companies do. That's what they're designed to do. And how you then enforce the price cap with this kind of move, I don't know. I mean, the other thing to think about is that this is probably going to be something that's going to rumble on between now and 2025, and what the future of gas prices and energy prices will be in the next 3 years is so incredibly difficult to predict. We've mentioned before that the price cap is predicted to rise again by October. We also had noises when the price cap changed last week that it might be under review more often than every 6 months. So these things can change very, very quickly. And as I said, there's a lot of moving parts to it. There's lots of things to consider. And what we'll do, as I said, we've had a lot of people writing questions. I've just taken a couple of questions from what you've asked, and we're going to go away and obviously get all of these answered and get a bit more clarity over what this all means.
All right. I think we've all had enough of energy for now, though. Can we leave this to one side? But it does filter into what we're about to talk about next, and that is inflation. the Bank of England warning that it could peak at 7.25% this spring. And as Simon fairly points out in his article, if its track record is anything to go by, that might be an understatement. So Simon, what can we do to beat it? Many a personal finance journalist have been asked this question. You have the answer, don't you?
I don't have the answer. I have some figures that people might need to consider if they are looking at it. But just to say, the US often leads and we follow. And over there, inflation has hit 7.5%.
Ouch.
It was
predicted to go up even further as well.
Yeah, it is actually. Yeah. And then there's lots of talk about the Fed being behind the curve on it and so on. Mm. I think the thing with inflation is people always... they hear about it. It sounds bad. They know that 7% is not a good number. But they feel things getting more expensive more than they actually feel that number or understand how that number actually feeds into their finances. So what I tried to do in my column was take a look at, okay, well, what would you need to do to claw that back? Because if we accept that inflation is inevitable, okay, the cost of stuff is going up. And unfortunately, it appears to be largely affecting the cost of essential things. It's hitting our energy bills, as we have talked about in great detail. The cost of filling up a car is brutally expensive and actually eats up quite a bit of a chunk of people's income, probably more for most people than their energy bills for now, until their energy bills go up a load soon. Food as well. Tesco's boss warned that that was going to get worse. And just basically anything that we seem to be buying. I certainly am definitely feeling inflationary effects and that my spending is getting more expensive. But if you think about it, inflation affects you in three ways. So it affects your spending power, affects your income, and it affects your wealth. So if we look at the average household or the average person, what would they need to do to combat this? With the massive caveat that there is no such person as the average. The average is always a bit of a weak thing, isn't it? It's like everybody goes, well, that's not me. I'm not that. It's like, yeah, but you know, there is an average. So spending. Okay. How much do you think the average UK household spends every week? This doesn't include mortgage interest payments and council tax.
I've cheated. I've read your article, Simon.
Oh, okay.
Lee, have you read Simon's article? Of course you have. You know the answer.
Yeah. Yeah, it's £588 a week.
So what surprised me is that doesn't include mortgage or rent, does it?
I think it does include rent. It just doesn't include mortgage interest payments.
Over £2,000 a month. That's quite a lot, isn't it?
£2,352 a month. It's an awful lot. It's a lot. I mean, that is a lot. That is a household, though. That's not a person. That is a household. Oh, right. So in many instances, that will be families.
Yeah.
And it includes... all of the spending that goes on the kids as well within families that have kids. But it is a lot. It does feel like a lot. I was surprised, to be honest. If you base it on that number and 7% inflation, a household would need to not spend £165 a month just to stay on the level. Now, that's a pretty hefty figure when you think, hang on a minute, at the end of every month, I'm not really being left over with much money in my kind of household spending element. But you do have to bear in mind that household spending includes everything, including discretionary stuff, because I think when we talk about household spending, we think, oh, that's just the essentials, but it's not. It's everything you spend on. So if you break it down, it equates to £41 a week. Break it down further, the question becomes, can you save a tenner a week on four different things? That all of a sudden becomes a much more manageable scenario, doesn't it? Do you reckon there's four different things that every week you could not spend a tenner on?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's kind of manageable. Income, right. The median full-time UK salary is £31,285, according to the ONS. A sentence that led to endless comments from people going, well, I don't earn that. Or, well, I earn more than that. Well, I earn less than that. It's the median, guys. It's where you line everyone up and it's the one in the middle. Okay. So it doesn't mean that you earn it. But you've got to use some number, and it's better to use the actual ONS median salary number rather than just making one up out of thin air. So what matters, obviously, is what you earn, not the average person in what Britain earns. But you can work that one out from your own payslip. Now, sadly, most people are not going to be getting 7% wage increases this year. And they will not have been reassured by Bank of England boss Andrew Bailey on his £575,000 a year salary, advising them not to ask for pay rises in order to combat inflation. So let's pretend that we're going to pay...
In his defence, he said big pay rises, and that does include pensions as well.
I know exactly what I know what he said. I just think he may... And I know he was answering...
A bit out of touch.
I also know that he was answering a question. I just think it's a little awkward if you earn nearly 600 grand a year and you say anything that might then be used against you in such a way. So what do you need to do? How much would you extra would you need to get in every month to make up for the money that you're losing? Based on that £31,285, £183 a month. Now, making extra money is far from easy. It's going to require some time and effort. The good news is that has got easier in the digital age. I'm not going to reel out a load of suggestions because it's I hate that kind of stuff. But you might have skills or expertise someone's willing to pay you for a few hours per week for. Or you could maybe do a bit of wheeling and dealing, selling some stuff you don't need, buying things and selling them on. Break it down as we did with the other one, and you're going to need to make an extra roughly £46 a week to do that average earnings thing. And I said in my column that if you do want to do some of that wheeling and dealing and buying and selling stuff, then go buy Lee's book, Never Go Broke. Lee can, I think, tell us a little bit here about making bits of extra money. You reckon everyone can make some money from stuff in their house, don't you, Lee?
I've got to say, Simon, thank you so much for keep on plugging the book. Like, you've plugged the book recently more than I have. There's all sorts of things you can do. And actually, selling things like your talents, as Simon was just saying there, is actually easier than it's ever been before. And there's lots of ways to go about doing that and sort of having to think about where your talents lie. And things you can do, things like rent out your driveway. You'd be surprised, people like to dodge like car park prices by a train station, for example, or if you're near a sports ground, that kind of thing. There's lots of little easy wins like that. And then inside your home, we've all got a mass of stuff. We've got so much stuff. And, you know, when Simon breaks it down like that and how much, you know, extra is needed to sort of beat this crunch, I think it's really doable. It's really easy. And I even sometimes just walk around the streets around here and there's this stuff just dumped on driveways, just says free to a good home. It doesn't take long to polish something up and then sell it on something like Facebook Marketplace. I know I've banged on about this a lot, but it's just so easy to do. There's so many little opportunities out there. And as the book is all about, you know, it's not about getting rich quick. I just don't think there's such a thing. It's more about just ticking away slowly, hence the name Never Go Broke. It's just about getting little wins here and there, and just sending things like your multimedia, your clothes. People will buy it. You'll be so surprised. And I think things like Facebook Marketplace just make it so simple. And if you make it part of your day, especially if you're working from home or whatever, and some people won't show up and all that kind of stuff, but it's pretty easy. And then actually it's a little bit more complex as the end of the book gets on. But with that pot, I always say you should keep that pot of money as a kind of bit of extra and segregate it somewhere else, and then go out and spend that money on more items to try and flip for profits, find your areas of expertise and just go for it.
I like that slow and steady. It sort of reminds me, Simon, of what you were saying earlier about breaking down that figure. I mean, when you think about the energy price gap going up by about 700 quid, that is a frightening amount of money. It's still frightening whether you break it down or not. But when you think it's £13 a week, you're like, okay, let's just focus on that. What can I do? Tick away, sell something for, I don't know, 25 quid. That's 2 weeks covered. I like that theory. Simon, any other tips and tricks?
Well, the final one is your wealth, isn't it? So in terms of spending power and income, inflation is something that we feel in the moment immediately, but it's probably more corrosive over the long term to your wealth than it is to anything else. Because if you are regularly earning a below inflation return for many years, that compounds and gets quite bad when you start to do the maths. Unfortunately, a savings account with an interest rate below 1% isn't going to help you much when inflation is 7%. And history shows that investing in the stock market is the best way of beating inflation over time. Doesn't mean you'll beat it every year, doesn't mean you'll beat it this year, but once you start stretching it out to periods of, say, 5 years, for example, then you should do. Now, you need to keep an emergency fund in cash. You need to be wary of investing anything you need in the short term. But money that's over and above that, you know, if you want to combat high inflation, you're going to have to invest it. And a combination of dividends and share price growth from a well-diversified portfolio could potentially get you 7% a year. But that is a big ask to regularly get that year in, year out. It used to be people just expected that kind of number. But, you know, recent years, you're not necessarily going to get it. But averaged out over 5 years, you're definitely going to get closer to inflation, even high inflation, than you are leaving your money in a savings account. And actually, what's interesting when I looked at the numbers on this the other day was that the UK stock market has been a bit of a laggard in recent years. You know, the US stock market's been the place to be. That's been surging ahead. Even if you just invested in the global stock market, you'd have done much better than just investing in the UK. But even if you just look at the FTSE All Share, it's delivered an average annual total return of 5.4% over 5 years and 6.8% over 3 years. And bear in mind that that is a time period that includes when the market crashed by a third in that sort of early period of COVID. So we've actually seen a proper big market crash in that period, and people have still averaged out 5.4% returns over 5 years. You won't have had that in a savings account. Ideally, you don't just go invest in the UK. That's doing it wrong. Easiest thing, put your money into a low-cost global tracker fund. That's a good starting point. You can start trying to pick other things that you think might do better, but bear in mind that once you start trying to pick things that might do better, they actually might not end up doing as well as the market. And also, a really important thing for investors to bear in mind at the moment is the circumstances have changed, and circumstances that made some stuff do very well in recent years may not be the same now, and therefore mean that those same things do very well in years to come.
Good advice there, Simon. Although I have a question. Because obviously inflation is eroding your any money in your savings, you want to be looking at investing. If you want to buy a house, saving for the deposit is, I'd suggest, one of the toughest things to do. So obviously you don't want it sat there losing 7% or whatever it might be losing. You want to think about making the most of it. But what if you want to buy your house in a few years' time? All of the advice is 5 years, 10 years investing, you're in it for the long haul. Does your advice change in this environment? You've spoken to the experts. What do you reckon? 3 years? Is that all right, Lee?
Well, so basically, we're talking about lifetime ISAs here, right? So
we could be, Lee. We could be.
I think that's probably the best way to look at this, right? So you want to buy a house. A lot of it's going to depend on your sort of horizons, as in like your time frame. Like if you're looking to buy a house within the next 3 years, it's probably wise, if you're between the ages of 18, 39 and a first-time buyer, to get a lifetime ISA. Now, you might be listening to that saying, but haven't you been critical of lifetime ISAs in the past? And yes, I have. And I am critical of lifetime ISAs because of the conflicting things that it can be used for, either buying a home or buying a property. Buying a home or saving for your retirement. And if you're thinking about it purely from you're going to buy a home, like you really are adamant you're buying a first home and that's what you're going to use it for, I would say that a lifetime ISA is actually a pretty good bet. And the reason why I say that is that you could put up to $4,000 into it. And if you put that maximum in, you'll get £1,000 bonus from the government. Now, you're not going to get that return anywhere else, you know, unless you're investing and have a good year. And we always say that really investing is a five-year minimum kind of thing. So look, if you're 18 and you're thinking really long-term horizon, you want to start saving for a home, and there's no reason why at 18 you shouldn't be thinking along those lines, you could potentially get an investment version of a lifetime ISA, thinking that you might buy in 5-10 years. I mean, that would be incredibly sensible for an 18-year-old to do, but it's not outside the realms of possibility, especially if you're getting help potentially from a parent or grandparent or whoever. If you're someone, let's say you want to buy a home, you're already saving for it and you want to get somewhere in the next couple of years, there's going to be more likelihood of fluctuation in terms of stock market investing. You know, and that's why there's always that kind of 5-year minimum. And at the end of the day, you're getting that 25% bonus anyway, which is pretty good going. And some providers offer, I think you can get a 0.6% is about the highest you can get. So you're getting a little bit of return. Yeah, that's nowhere near inflation. But 25% return is, I mean, that's one of the only inflation-busting ways to currently save. So that is a pretty good idea if you're going to buy. Now, and if you think about it, if you're buying as a couple, that's then potentially boosted to 10 grand a year that you can save. So 8 grand you put in, 2 grand bonus. You do that for 2.5 years, and then you're looking at the average 10% deposit. You know, 25 grand is a massive hurdle for a lot of people to buy an average home with a 10% deposit. I mean, that is massive for a lot of people. But you've got to start. Once you start,
but you're saying stay with cash because you're going to get the bonus anyway and focus on the bonus.
Personally, that's how I would look at it. That's I wouldn't be thinking about, as I say, it depends, because it really does depend on your time frame. Personally speaking, I think if you're looking to save under 5 years, I would probably be looking at the cash version of the account, just because you're getting that chunky bonus anyway. Simon might disagree, but that's what I think.
But how much have houses gone up over the last 5 years? More than inflation.
Okay, so a house.
I'm not saying you're going to get that by investing.
The average house, to go back to our conversation about averages and not really existing earlier with that caveat, the average house has gone up by £24,500 in the last year alone.
Well, there you go.
If you're a first time buyer, you're going, okay. right, yeah, how am I going to save that? I mean, the good news is that you don't have to save that whole £24,500. Most people buy with a mortgage. And even if you're buying with, but even if you're buying with a 25% mortgage, that's six grand extra you're going to need in your deposit. Obviously, if you're buying with a smaller deposit mortgage, you're going to need less. But I think, okay, the official answer, right, the proper financial advice answer here, that what you should do is exactly what Lee just said. If you've got a time horizon of less than 5 years, you probably shouldn't be investing. Certainly if you need the money in its entirety and it's going to cause you a problem. And I'll give you the answer that we've got in the article from Jason Hollands of Tilney Investment Management. Jason says, the answer to this really depends on your time horizon. While accumulating cash savings offers little in the way of returns, in fact, negative returns after inflation is factored in, you are not going to wake up one day and potentially find your account has fallen by a third, with the possible exception of your bank having gone bust. Even in this rare scenario, savings up to £85,000 held with institutions with a UK banking license are protected under the Financial Services Compensation Scheme. In contrast, while investing has historically won hands down compared to cash over the longer term, it involves risk capital because the value of stocks and shares fluctuates. Therefore, investing should only be considered as an option by those prepared to take a medium to longer term view, such as 5 years or more, so that there is time to recover from any shorter term pullbacks on the way. Short term volatility in financial markets can partially be tamed by both the choice of investment selected, shares being the most risky, but also the way you choose to invest. So if it's within the next 5 years, you probably shouldn't be investing. Now, the only thing I would say is, in my mind, the lifetime ISA, as Lee said, really muddies the waters here. Now, you have to be able to qualify for the lifetime ISA, and not everybody does. But if you can qualify for a lifetime ISA, you're getting that 25% uplift on all the money you put in. Now, you've got two choices here. You can save in cash and you can go, I'm getting 25% on this. I'm highly unlikely to be getting 25% returns instantly on any investment I make in my life. And that is a good enough investment for me. So I am totally happy to take the 25%. Or you can go, I'm going to use a lifetime ISA. I'm going to take my 25% instant bonus. And then I'm going to invest as well to try and turbocharge those returns. But I'm going to be cognizant of the fact that the market could crash and I could end up down suddenly by a large amount. But I do have a buffer built in, 25% buffer, in fact, that I have been given in terms of my instant return. But the market could fall by more than that. I could still end up. What happens if we had that crash we talked about, the 33% crash, the COVID crash? What happens if that happens? We've got some very popular funds at the moment that are down by 20-30%. What happens if that happens to my money? Am I going to be okay if I've lost my whole bonus and I've lost a little bit more than that? Am I willing to take that risk? And that is really only a question that an individual can answer for themselves, which is why the general advice is don't do it if you need all of that money. But, you know, I think perhaps maybe if it was me, I might be willing to take the risk, maybe not with all of the money, but maybe with some of it.
That would be a spectacular, I was about to swear then, bad moment for the markets, for you to lose all of that. Because even in the rocky times, I have a lifestyle advisor, as you know. I actually opened it originally with a view. Again, it was like, well, I'm only probably going to have it for a couple of years. I'll take the risk. I'll go investing because I factored in the bonus. As it transpires, I've had it for a little bit longer than that. But, you know, I lost a fair whack. But only of the investment gains, about half the investment gains that I'd made, hadn't touched the bonus nor any of the stuff that I contributed. It would have to be something spectacular, wouldn't it, Simon?
You'd have to be really unlucky. You'd have had to put all of your money into your lifetime ISA right at the point when stuff peaked and then needed to get it all out right at the point when stuff was at the bottom. Mm. It's not inconceivable, though.
Yeah.
Stock markets have gone up a lot, particularly if you look at the US market. It's riding very, very high on a number of valuation metrics. And markets that go up by a lot, when they can eventually crash and then stay down for quite a long time, people do have to bear that in mind. When you look at the numbers, as you lengthen out that investment period, your chances of losing money get smaller and smaller and smaller. But you're right, you would have to be spectacularly unlucky. But if you're going to do
that, it doesn't happen.
But people do get spectacularly unlucky.
Discount
the fact that people do get spectacularly unlucky. Mm. But I tell you what, if you are going to take a risk with your house deposit, the money you save with your house deposit, better to do it in a stocks and shares lifetime ISA than whack it into crypto, because the crypto bunnies are telling you they're making, you know, returns of a couple of 100%. Because that is the kind of place where you could suddenly turn around and you've lost all your money.
Right, we're going to leave LISAs to one side and talk about cars. Because of the stuff going up most in price at the moment, one of the most notable, I think, has to be second-hand cars. Oh, how we used to laugh at those people who bought, we didn't really laugh, but we just said we'd never do it ourselves, who bought new, knowing the value dropped like 50% the second you drive it off that shiny showroom forecourt. But over the last year, we've seen the price of used cars skyrocket, some as much as 69%. Lee, why is that?
It's just so difficult to get your hands on a brand new car. The waiting list to go into a dealership and get yourself ordered a brand spanking new car can be 12 months, if not longer, in many circumstances, due to the chip shortage that we've mentioned on this podcast before. It's becoming difficult to keep up supply and demand, essentially. And people, for that reason, are having to turn to the second-hand car market.
You need a car, right?
Exactly. And some of the most sought-after models, is just incredible, looking at the list of prices and how much in a year extra you could be paying for a second-hand car. Some astronomical examples in here. The 69% one that you highlighted there is a Toyota Urus hybrid. In January 2021, it would typically cost you £10,046. By this
Second-hand, yeah.
And then £16,950 you'd expect.
How much is it first-hand or whatever? New, I think it's called.
Sorry, Georgia, I don't have an intrinsic. I'm not a walking Parker's guide. I've got absolutely no idea, I'm afraid. But
why not?
But in all seriousness, there are examples of used cars that are now more expensive than if you bought brand new.
That's
the mad scenario that we're in. And actually, this
I'll get the figures from Simon. It's fine.
This piece of research that Rob's done is really a real deep dive into this, because it looks at not just one specific website or whoever, you know, one of the big guys like Auto Trader. It looks at a whole of market. It's really gone into detail, and this is a really accurate snapshot of what people are after. And actually, this list, there's a good 20 to 25 cars in this list that are up 50% in value in a year from January to January. And it's a real mix of petrol and diesel cars. There are two hybrids and one electric, but the rest of it is just petrol and diesel.
Wow. Okay.
People just scrambling to buy a decent secondhand car, Georgie, because they can't get their hands on a new one. Who wants to go into a dealership and say, I want this brand new, whatever model it is, and then the salesperson say, yeah, that's great, but you probably won't
get a year.
For a year, maybe 18 months. Mm. A lot of people are just going to walk out and go. And that's why we've had big problems when we look at these SMMT figures, which is the official figures for new car sales. It's struggled. Struggling. There's massive struggles over this, and there's a bottleneck that's formed.
Simon, how much is a Toyota Yaris, did you say? Toyota new?
So we've got two sets of figures here. We've got the figures for the three-year-old cars and how much a three-year-old car cost this time a year ago and how much the same three-year-old car would cost you now, which has got some of those really big 50% rises in. Now, obviously, that three-year-old car a year ago is now a four-year-old car. It's not quite the same car. Now, what we've also got is the figures for year-old used cars that are selling for more than they cost new. Right. And to pick out the Toyota Yaris that you just mentioned, Toyota Yaris hybrid would average new price £22,222.
Yeah.
Average one-year-old used price now £22,583.
Get out.
So
of
your
town.
Year-old, yeah. If you bought a Yaris brand new a year ago, it's now worth £362 more than it was when you paid for it.
Insane.
So it's gone up by 2%. Now, bearing in mind that the general rule of thumb is the moment you drive a car off the forecourt, you lose about a quarter of its value.
Yeah.
This is quite an astonishing turnaround because that quarter's back in the... You've got the top-up of the quarter back in there. It's like sticking a car in your lifetime ISA. And you've made a 2% return on the value of the car. But up the top of the pile, I love the fact that this is at the top of the pile, is the Dacia Sandero. I mean, Dacias are cheap and cheerful cars. The average price of a Dacia Sandero, brand new, is £10,173. It's amazing you can buy a brand new car for that, okay? But the average one-year-old price now is £12,026. That's £1,853 more. It's gone up in value by 18% in the past year. And then after that, you've got the Land Rover Defender. We're going a lot more higher up the cost scale here. 53,967 brand new, £63,265 for a year old one. That's gone up by £9,298, 17% rise. The biggest monetary value is on a Tesla Model X. That's £94,492 new, £106,472 for a 1 year old one, which is up £11,981 or a 13% rise in a year. This is completely bananas. I don't really see it lasting for that much longer. One of the indicators that I don't see it lasting for that much longer is, I think I mentioned this on a podcast a few weeks ago, I managed to save £150 on my car hire recently. I had to book a car for the weekend. I went snowboarding for the weekend to Austria, flew into Switzerland, drove into Austria. And when I'd booked it, it cost me £325 for the 3 days, which is really expensive because car hire in Zurich is not normally expensive. I then looked at it randomly a couple of weeks ago and I managed to find the same level of car for £175 instead. Now, this indicates to me that the car hire companies are suddenly starting to get deliveries of cars. And that tells me that there's being a bit of a step up in the delivery of new cars if the car hire companies are managing to get their hands on them and the costs are coming down. And maybe over the next 6 months or so, we're going to start to see things get back to a little bit more like normal in the car market. But I think what we're going to see is a big wave of people buying new cars, though, because it's clearly, we talk about this pent-up demand scenario and lots of things. I think there might clearly be a bit of a pent-up demand for buying new cars. So I think they're going to be in short supply for some time.
All right, then. Finally, a good news story for a long-time friend of This Is Money and Lee's. The Bank of Dave is getting the star treatment and it's going to be made into a Hollywood film. Lee, for anyone who doesn't know anything about this, Bank of Dave, etc., take us right back.
Oh, Mr. David Fishwick. Yeah, longtime friend of This Is Money, myself and Simon. He's a good guy. He's a good dude. 10 years ago, he took on the big banking boys, set up his own bank, Burnley Savings and Loans. And it was covered on a Channel 4 programme and in a book. And basically, it was all about his battle to get a banking licence because he wanted to lend money out to businesses and local people in Burnley, where he's from, who were getting turned down for the big banks in the aftermath of the financial crisis. Dave is a self-made millionaire with his minibus business. So he sells second-hand minibuses. And he was finding a lot of businesses were struggling to get financed after that financial crisis. There's a lot of centralized decisions and all that kind of thing. So Dave took matters into his own hands and took on the big banks. And basically, he won. You know, he managed to get his banking license, and the rest is history. So this week, fast forward to this week. And I should also mention here, back in 2014, I went on a little road trip with Dave. I went and met him. Up in Burnley, and he took me around to all of the local areas, Accrington and those sorts of places. And I met some of the businesses in which he'd lent to after they'd been turned down elsewhere and how they were flourishing. Now, this week, I got a very, very, very excited phone call from Dave. Very excited. It was just one of those moments. I was sitting down in the office and I had no idea what it was going to be about. And Dave proceeded to tell me that they were making a movie about his life for Netflix, which I was kind of lost for words for. I think it's a great thing. I think in the last sort of decade or so, there's been lots of feel-good British movies. And I think this definitely sort of fits into that mould, you know, David versus the Goliath type stuff. And it's got a great cast, because my first thought in my mind was, well, who's going to play Dave? And Dave is going to be played by Rory Kinnear, who I think is a great actor. And anyone who's a Black Mirror fan and has ever seen the first episode of Black Mirror, I think would recognise him when he plays the Prime Minister. And I can't describe what else happens in that episode, but very good actor. And it's got Phoebe Denevere in it as well, who massive star after Bridgerton, which is one of Netflix's biggest programs, and also the daughter of Sally Webster, so a bit of a Lancashire we're going back to Coronation Street here. Sally Webster out of Coronation Street's daughter, you know, so it's got that kind of vibe. And also Joel Fry, who you'd recognize probably out of Yesterday, which was the film about the Beatles. So it's got a really good cast. Filming starts at the end of this month. I can't give away too much more. Dave gave away quite a lot in the phone call, but you know how these things work. I can't go into too much more detail than that. But we're hoping to get behind the scenes of one day of the filming. That would be good. And we could report back on that in the next few months. And we're made up for him. I think it's fantastic news.
Indeed, very good news and something nice to end on. Right, that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcast past, join in the debate and read the comments.
Marvellous. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.